No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Together with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Hello, America, and welcome to the show. We have, it's Maria and I tonight. Maria's running a little late, so I'm going to start out talking about some of the things that have gone on in the last couple of weeks. But Maria's been traveling all over the world, and I have too, so we want to talk about that. And we also want to talk about the big, historic hearing that we had before the House Oversight and Reform Committee on Thursday of this week. It was the first hearing we've had in 25 years on the D.C. statehood bill. But first, I want to say a few words on a sad note. We just found out that we lost a champion for our cause, a man named Mark Plotkin. Many of you might have known him. He was on WTOP, which was a local station here in Washington, D.C. for 10 years. He had a show on politics. He was a former candidate for public office in the District of Columbia. I actually worked on his campaign for the city council many, many years. I can't even remember. Back in the 1980s, I believe, or maybe it was the early 1990s. But anyway, he was a great guy and stood up for statehood every opportunity he got. He was a local newsman who got to ask the President of the United States a question, and that's very unusual for the local press. And what did Mark ask? Mark asked a question about statehood. He was all about statehood. He was all in. He was one of our biggest supporters. Our deepest condolences go out to his friends and his family. He was a nice man and an inspiration to me, and he was a guest on our show. He was actually last on in August of 2016, so just about 3 years ago. And we're really going to miss his enthusiasm for our cause and his stand-up attitude about it. He really was all in. Rest in peace, Mark Plotkin. You will be missed. But now let's move on to some of the other things that have happened this week. Maria's been traveling all over. I'm sure she will join us shortly and tell us all about that. And I've been traveling as well. I talked a little bit about it on the show a few weeks ago. Talked about India. But we'll talk about more of it tonight. And let me just say that our historic meeting on the Hill on Thursday, I'm going to wait for Maria to talk about that because we want to get into that detail. But the reason that we're meeting in front of the Government Reform and Oversight and Reform Committee was to talk about H.R. 51, the D.C. statehood bill. We now have two more co-sponsors. So our shout out, we have to, a shout out to Cynthia Axe. I'm sorry, Axne. Cynthia Axne. I'm trying to do two things at one time, read a message from Maria. But Cynthia Axne, who's in the Iowa 3rd District, of course, a Democrat, and Angie Craig, a Democrat from Minnesota 2nd District, both new co-signers on the bill, bringing the total of co-signers to 221, enough to pass the bill without any additional support. So that's just great news. And also, I want to say that we got Dianne Feinstein from California. But I see that Maria is just about with us. Can we get her up on Skype, Doug? Because we're going to bring her on to the show. Okay. And
here okay. we are. Here
All
we
right.
are.
Thanks.
Yahoo.
Maria, you're
yes,
back.
Sir.
You're
yes,
back.
Yes,
well,
sir.
I want to tell you, now that you're here, I want to brag a little bit. One of the people that we got to sign on to the bill this week was Dianne Feinstein. Yeah, and we met with Feinstein with her chief of staff about 2 months ago. It was 2 days after her birthday. I bought her chocolates that were handmade from chocolatiers in Washington in every ward of the city.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so we bought her all these handmade truffles, and I don't know if that's what put her over the top or not, but we're bragging about getting her on the bill, which now means that both senators in California and California still leads with 44 co-sponsors on the House bill. The next biggest state is New York with 19. So you guys are just like way ahead. And now both senators. So 46 co-sponsors from the state of California. God bless you out there.
Yay.
And I really want to get into talking about the hearing. But first, I want to talk about our travels. And in case you missed it, I said some nice words about Mark Plotkin, who we lost. He was 72 years old, and he was a guest on our show 3 years ago in August. You might remember.
Wow.
He was a strong statehood advocate, and we're really going to miss him. But let's talk about you for a minute. Where have you been? I know you've been all over the place. Tell us where and why.
So I went to Dubai for 3 nights, but it was really just 2 days because I arrived on Sunday evening at 7 o'clock. It's a 16-hour flight nonstop from Los Angeles. Mm. So that in itself is interesting. And then Dubai is, the heat was, I've never experienced anything like it. It penetrates your very core and fiber. You cannot cool down. So that was exhausting too. I was out and about in old Dubai. I didn't do the new stuff with the skyscrapers and the tallest building, and I had that on my little list, but it was going to be too arduous, and the distance between old Dubai, where I was staying, and new Dubai was about 40 minutes. And I was happy to do that because I went to a cultural awareness breakfast that they sat us down on the floor and told us what they do and why, and then it was a traditional breakfast that they served. And then did a walking food tour. We went into the food souk and the spice souk and took a water taxi to get there. So that those kinds of things meant more to me than being in the tallest building in the world, even though that was on my list and had tickets for it at sunset, et cetera, et cetera. Also did some research for my dissertation because female genital mutilation is a problem in that part of the world. But doing my interviews, it turns out that the UAE is fairly progressive and it isn't as prevalent and prominent as it is in some of the other 30 countries that practice it. So that was heartening to hear because I'm gathering as much information as possible to help. I'm trying to eradicate the procedure in my lifetime. I know that's ambitious, but because it's been going on for over 2,000 years. But to talk to the to people that actually have experienced it, which is what I did when I went to the University of Leeds in late April, I met a woman from Somalia who's an activist, and she spoke about her personal experience, and she's doing what she can in the UK. And then on to the Maldives, and that was for vacation. That was a four-hour flight from Dubai to Maldives. It's probably the most beautiful place in the world. But because of the logistics to get there, they say that they see very few Americans. Because once got to Maldives, then it's a high-speed boat ride to the resort because they're on atolls. So they're completely surrounded by water. There's no way to get there except for by watercraft. And that was total and complete relaxation. Swim, read, eat, sleep, sun.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I want to be you.
I did some research there, too, because the Maldives is its own country, and it is 100% Muslim. My understanding is you can't be in the Maldives and not be Muslim. In fact, we met an American woman there who is marrying a man from the Maldives, and she's having to convert to Islam. And they have bought a home, and she, in order to own real estate, you have to be a Muslim. So it's part, there is no separation, shall we say, of church and state.
Well, you know, it's funny that at the conference in Portugal, one of the heads of states that was attended the conference that I was, you know, that I go to every year. I've gone to it 2 years now, and I've been invited back for a third year. But one of the heads of state was from the Maldives.
Really?
Yeah. So, and he came with quite an entourage. There were other heads of state there that, you know, had small security teams and stuff, of course. But he came with an entourage. You know, I mean, it really was something.
And it's a tiny little country.
Yeah.
I don't recall the population, but and it's almost all atolls except for where Mali is, where the airport is. But they're just expanding the airport because we took an A380 to get to Dubai, but then you take a 777 to get to Mali because it's a smaller. But they've expanded the runway that they're now going to take the jumbo jets, and Bin Laden's construction company is doing the work there.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And so it was just interesting to see. And like the Muslim women who were at the resort, they were completely dressed in their habib, I think it's called. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. And even when swimming, they were covered from ankles to wrists.
Yeah.
With their swimwear.
In a burqa?
Not in the burqa. It was like yoga pants and a wetsuit. But yeah, they were covered, and it was hot, very hot.
Yeah.
And my heart just, you know, and the women in Dubai were all dressed in black. And the men dress in white.
Yeah.
The one who, you know, when they wear the flowing gowns or robes or whatever you call it with the white thing that they have on their head, the women are all in black.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey. Every woman above 40 years old was dressed in black because they were all widows. But
it's
It's an amazing culture thing, right?
Yes.
I go to India.
Can you talk about that? Flew there. You were deciding whether to go east or west. What did you end up doing?
Well, I went east and had the same experience that you had pretty much. 14 hours on a plane, but 14 hours doesn't get you to where I went. 14 hours gets you to Qatar. When I got there, I then had another 4.5 hour flight to Hyderabad, as they call it. And it's a big city in the south. But there was a lot going on. One of the things that was amazing, they have this a guy named Modi who's head of the country, maybe. Our listeners are familiar with him. He's meeting with President Trump as we speak. I think. They're having a meeting either today or tomorrow. And he's a new leader. He wants to bring about a Hindu government. So the first thing he did is he cut off, not the first thing, but one of the first things he did was he cut off all communications to Kashmir, which is a state of India. He cut out the internet. He cut off all phone communications, no mail, no nothing. And they couldn't communicate with the outside world. And it's because it's a state of 15 million Muslims. It's one of the first people that I met over there was a young woman doctor who had basically been driven out of Kashmir and moved to another part of the country where she could practice because they just clamped down on the whole state. 15 million Muslims. So that was very strange. And you know, there are a lot of Muslims in India. I don't know how many, a lot of Hindus, of course, as well. But that was the politics that was going on. And then I was part, I was in Hyderabad, which is Hyderabad, they call it, which is 8 million people and is kind of the center of their technology corridor, that and a place called Bangalore, which is really nearby. And it's just such a crazy mix. Maybe you found this where you were as well, since you were in the Arab world, but you know, here you have technology that's better than American technology in a lot of ways. But then you just have a, you know, throngs and throngs of really poor people. There was a trial going on. You know, you're talking about genital mutilation. There was a trial going on in Hyderabad at when I was there of a man who paid, I think, $150,000 to another guy to hack his son-in-law to death with a butcher knife, which he did in front of his pregnant wife.
Dear Lord.
Because she married beneath her caste. And so that's not, she's from a little town outside of Hyderabad. They went to Hyderabad and got married in a Hindu, kind of a reformed Hindu church, right? But the really bizarre thing about it is there's the man is on trial right now, and there's hundreds of people coming to support him to say he did the right thing by having his son-in-law killed.
Oh my
and,
God.
And they killed him. His wife, you know, the daughter and he were leaving the hospital after their first prenatal visit, and this guy attacked him and killed him in front of the daughter. Now the daughter lives with his parents, of course. She can't go back to home to her parents. But there's people, you know, that are standing up for him saying, of course he did the right thing. Just blew me away. But for the most part, it was a great conference. People from all over the world. I was treated like visiting royalty. It was great.
Remind our listeners why you were invited and what the conference was about.
Well, the conference was about resilience. It was about what we're doing in the world, given the changing economic and political conditions. How are we going to move forward, and are we going to move forward together? And there were panels on things like what women are doing and how women are progressing. And there were some amazing women there, people that had just accomplished, you know, tremendous things and had been through all sorts of arduous, you know, trials and tribulations to get where they were. And their stories were really, really compelling. I've got to tell you that if there was a standout from the conference, it was really about what women were doing and how investments that have been made in women in the third world have paid just amazing dividends. You know, that they were, that when you, it seems that when you invest in women, especially in the third world, women tend to invest in things like their families and their communities and their, you know, they don't, if they make it, they don't go out and buy a Ferrari. They go, they invest, you know, they invest in their kids' education. They reinvest in their businesses. They, you know, they really, there were some really remarkable stories like, women who were becoming Sherpas in the Himalayas, and a Sherpa makes 100 times what, a guide, what, you know, what, somebody who carries, I don't know what you call the people that carry, your supplies, but that's what women traditionally do. And if you're a Sherpa, you can make as much as $20,000 for a single trip. As the head guide, and you know, just, and it's not any more risky than walking up to the top of the mountain with the backpack on either. You know what I mean? You're not, you know, it takes a certain amount of training and expertise, and there's stuff that you have to go through. It's funny. It's almost like a college education. But then when you get there, the rewards are substantial. So they talked about things like that, which I never knew about, which were just amazing, and how they're bringing the world together, trying to anyway, to deal with each other economically and politically. And, you know, it's really amazing to me. When I was there, traffic like you've never seen. I thought I'd seen it all. I've been to Mexico City. I've been to Manhattan. I've been to Los Angeles, you know, but this was just amazing. And for every car, there are maybe 10 motorcycles, maybe even more.
Laden, I thought I told you that. Laden, I remember one motorcycle had 5 people on it. The
right,
mother,
exactly
the father,
right.
And 3 children on
but
one
the motorcycle. Yeah, but the best part of that is that the baby is hanging onto the handlebars in the front, and the wife is riding side saddle because she's in a sari, mm-hmm. You know, and you know, and that's what I'm thinking. If you don't like your wife, you just make a hard left-hand turn, right?
In Pitcher.
The motorcycle for years. But the thing, yeah. The point that I'm trying to make is there are so many of those scooters. You've been there. You've seen it. And I met one of the women at the conference was the head of Harley-Davidson India. And she offered to, she goes, well, I've got a couple of bikes if you want to go for a ride. And I'm like, are you kidding? You've seen the traffic over there. I'm like, no. Maybe 40 years ago, I might have been crazy enough to try it, but not anymore.
Were there animals also?
Not as much, because this was very metropolitan area. Yeah, you saw some goats walking around in the street and stuff, but not, you know, not like the things you hear about in the little towns where, you know, you have just cows walking down the middle of the street.
Yeah,
because
I saw, I can't tell you how many, I mean, monkeys and cows and goats and chickens.
Never saw any monkeys, but I know
bigger
they're
bigger ones too. Yes, and I was like, that's why it took us almost 8 hours to go 150 miles or something.
Well, the point I'm trying to make with the motorcycles, though, is that this woman from Harley-Davidson has been there for 9 years.
Now, only?
There's 1.5 billion people, most of them on motorcycles, and Harley's only been there for you know, not you. It's like such a great marketplace, and it's would be such a bulwark for the United States against China in the sense of, you know, not only marketing, but manufacturing. You know, they have a really educated population, believe it or not. They mm-hmm. have 1,000 universities, mm-hmm. and education is free for the most part. And So they have an educated workforce. Well, you know, you have a problem with your computer. Who do you talk to?
You're right.
Routed, right? English is widely spoken. You know, by the way, I hate to brag, which isn't true. I love to brag.
Good, and you should.
I got an award from St. Mother Teresa's University. They named me Man of the People 2019. So I
wow.
said,
wow.
I said to Pat, I said, yeah, having Mother Teresa call you a man of the people, that's like Mick Jagger calling you, you know, like a badass rock and roller, right?
Yeah.
So that was quite an honor. But the funny part is they put a cap, they gave me like a degree, and it's like an honorary degree, and and they put a cap and gown on me, but they couldn't get a cap that fit. They finally just had my damn melon head is so big. They finally just had to rest the mortarboard on my head, and I had to try to balance it for pictures. But anyway, it was an amazing experience, and the conference was amazing in the sense that, you know, the more we learn about each other, the more we realize, I think, the more I realize that the challenges we face are basically the same.
Right. Universal. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a universality to our humanity as well. And you know, it's funny, I can't stop thinking with all this stuff that's gone on recently with the bombing in Saudi Arabia. One of the people that I bonded with in during the conference was a guy from Portugal who, you know, was at the conference in Portugal, and he's from Iran. You know, and he's an urban planner from Iran and just the nicest guy. And I kept on thinking, you know, and he talked about how horrible the American sanctions have been for him as a you know, an urban planner. He's not a, you know, it's not about the politics of the thing, like whether those sanctions are right or wrong. He doesn't necessarily support the government. But he's just talked about how tough those are. And all I can think of during all this stuff is, you know, there's going to be more sanctions. There's you know, that's certainly, you know, and maybe something even more dramatic than that, you know, but definitely it looks like, you know, our intelligence community has established that it was the Iranians that attacked Saudi Arabia, and there's going to be a response. And I just, you know, very often when you read the headlines, you know, they're faceless. You know, these conferences help us put a face to, you know, to the issues. Now when I think of Iran, I'll think of this guy, you know.
I bet. Did you recognize each other from Portugal?
Well, I got to tell you, you're not going to believe this. So I go to the airlines. Of course, I'm flying economy because the government's paying for it. So I go, and all I can think of is, oh, my God, 14 hours on a plane. I've never been on a plane more than, you know, 7 hours. So I go to the counter and I beg for, you know, whatever they can do to get me because I'm in the center seat, of course.
Oh, you're kidding.
So going, they get me an aisle seat with an empty seat next to me.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and then I get to Qatar, and I go to get on the plane to Hyderabad, and I see this guy. We're both waiting to get on the plane. So we talk, and, you know, 15 minutes. We talk for 15 minutes, then it's time to get on the plane. We shake hands and say, well, okay, well, we'll see you at the conference. And I say, okay, we get on the plane. We're sitting next to each other.
Oh, my. I love how life does things like that. How so great.
So then we get to Hyderabad. And, you know, coming back again, this time we arrange it. We talk to the airlines, and they seat us next to each other. Coming back, we also left on the same flight going back. So we sat next to each other going back to Qatar. And then again, I got an aisle seat with an empty seat next to me on the 14-hour flight back from Qatar. So, you know, it was as good as it could have been.
Still 14 hours
is a long time.
When I returned from India, I went from Delhi to Bangkok, Bangkok to Hong Kong, Hong Kong to L.A. Economy window. And that was 23 and a half hours of flying, not counting the time in between the flights, the layovers. So I feel your pain, Michael.
And that was a lot of flights coming back were 24 or 28 hours because of the layovers.
Yes.
I was lucky that I didn't have much of a layover. Now, this I thought was a really brilliant idea, and I would do this next time. If you go to Qatar, which is beautiful, by the way, you come into the airport. The airport's on the beach. I guess most of the country is surrounded by water. But you come in, and they have a luxury hotel connected to the airport. And if your layover is more than 12 hours, they will rent you a room at the spa for $40 a night. And so, that would be a good way to do it, you know, to relax. And it's also smart for them because nobody wants to lay over for more than 12 hours. So it helps them fill those flights, you know, to make this deal where you get this luxury room with a free massage and all this stuff for $40 if you have a layover more than 12 hours. So that, you know, if I ever did it again, I think I would do that.
When you landed and finally got to your ultimate destination, did the conference start the next day?
Yeah, the next
day. So you're dealing with that.
Right. And it didn't.
Time change, jet lag, and then got to get up and get fresh and get going.
Right. And actually, it started the same day. So I got in, but the deal is that I got in at 1:30 in the morning. And the first event for me was a dinner that night at 6 o'clock. So okay. I got to my room at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I got to get, you know, 8 hours sleep because I just went right to bed and didn't get up till noon the next day. Noon that
the same day. Right.
Yeah. And the conference actually started. My presentation was the next morning. And then I was on another panel, the next day. But it was an amazing experience. And I think these conferences are so important because they're bringing people together. And, you know, I've got to be honest. The reason I'm being invited to these things is because they can get me. You know what I mean? They can't get Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren to go to India for 6 days.
Right.
So. They can get me. I'm willing to come. I have this title, United States Senator. I make no bones about who I am. I go over there and I participate just like the other participants, and they love it. At one point, Maria, you'll love it. They had to cut off taking photos with me because I'd been standing there for 45 minutes. And there was a line. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's such an ego boost, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Just amazing. But also, some. It's a really positive thing, you know.
How long were you actually in the location?
I was only there for 5 days from the moment I landed till the time I left. So, and the conference was 3 days. So when you take that, it took a day to travel. I really only had one day, a full day in Hyderabad. And what happened was, you know, the conference was over at noon the day before. And then I had from then until like my flight, I had to leave for the airport at midnight the next day. So I had, maybe 36 hours. And they took me around, a couple of really nice guys took me around and showed me the sights. We also did some things while I was there. I mean, we went and we met with the police commissioner. This is a city with 8 million people, Maria, and they had one gun death so far this year.
Wow.
And in Washington, D.C., we've had 170 just in Washington, D.C.
My goodness.
Yeah, and their technology is amazing. They have cameras all over the street, kind of like we do now in this country. But they have face recognition software, which is 90% effective. And listen to this. If you're walking down the street, this is a little scary. They take your picture. They immediately compare it to all the outstanding warrants they have, okay? Mm-hmm. If there's a match, they instantly send your description and all the relevant information to the nearest police officer because all the cops are on GPS, and they come over and they arrest you. They've effected 140 arrests that way so far this year in the city. They've arrested 140 people just walking down the street. Yeah.
With 8 million that they're surveilling.
With 8 million. They're surveilling. And instantly comparing them to God knows how many millions of records. And policemen, now some of them carry guns, but some of them don't. The army carries guns. India has the largest standing army in the world. And you see them a lot of places. But cops in general do not carry guns. It's just amazing with that many people to control, too. And all the different cultures, lots of Muslims, lots of Hindus. They all speak three languages.
And did you see Sikhs?
A few, but not
only
not
a
many.
Few.
Yeah, but not many.
I wonder.
I was kind of in a part of Hyderabad which was primarily Hindu, but you did see Muslims. But it seemed that the area that I was in was primarily Hindu, and Hindu itself is an amazing religion. These guys told me that there are over 1,000 gods. They said every wow. town has a god. Every cause has a god. They said it's just amazing. Now, I don't think the people that I was with, for the most part, were practicing Hindus, but they were about to have a festival which goes 10 days. I'm sorry I missed this. I left just as the festival was starting on the first day, but they have a festival where they do, they make replicas of these gods that are maybe 25, 30 feet tall. They're usually done in plaster or some other material and painted. Most of them are of the elephant god, which is the top god, Ganesh, I think his name is, and they parade them around the city. They almost look like floats from Mardi Gras, and they carry them on trucks, and they put them all over the place. And then at the end of the week, at the end of the festival, they take them all and they dump them in a lake.
Oh.
I don't know if they dump them and then pull them. I hope they pull them back out, but they dump them in the lake, and it's kind of symbolizes washing away the old year and the sins of the old of the past and starting a new rebirth. You know, it's like like every religion has, right? For Christians,
right, a baptism.
Right, it's Easter for us. It's it's kind of like that for them. But it's supposed to be a great festival, and it goes on for 10 days.
What about alcohol? Was there any around?
You know what? Nobody drank. I noticed that. And there was one night when it was the first night and I was really tired. There was a dinner every night and they took some of us out to some really nice location for dinner. But the first night, the spa had three restaurants in it, and it was dinner at one of the restaurants. And they said, well, we're going to order some beer. And but I didn't hang around for that because I was tired and I went back to my room. But that's the only alcohol that I even heard of on the trip. They didn't drink at dinners, no wine, no, you know, they drink water mostly, bottled water. Yeah, no alcohol that I saw. And I never asked if that, you know, what that had to do, you know, whether Muslims drink or Hindus drink or what the deal is. But
well, Muslims don't, but in the UAE, you can only get alcohol in a restaurant that's attached to a hotel.
Right.
So the other restaurants, you know, say the sandwich places or the burger places or what have you, those kinds, no alcohol. And I wanted to bring, you can buy duty free at the Dubai airport on the way to the Maldives. And I was going to buy a bottle of something because the prices for the cocktails at the resort were ridiculous. They were $20 each. And they said, oh, no, you can't bring alcohol into the Maldives. It's not allowed.
Wow.
And so even in the lounge in the Maldives waiting to catch the flight to Dubai, there was juice and water.
Well, you know, there's this ridiculous synergy that you and I have because this was the big fight that almost got my ass arrested in Qatar. You know, I go to I'm in Hyderabad waiting for the plane and
to come home.
Yeah. And I see and I've got 20,000 rupees on me. And 20,000 rupees is not 20 bucks. It's
okay.
You know, it's about $16. So I'm like, well, what the hell am I going to do with this, right? I'm going to go exchange it someplace. I mean, it's $16.
And you'll get $11.50.
Right. And then I see there's a sign that says at the duty-free shop, absolute vodka, 19,900 rupees.
Oh, my gosh.
Great, because just before I leave, a couple of days before I leave, Mrs. Brown says to me, I wanted to have a cocktail, and Nick drank all the vodka, you know, our son, 24-year-old son. So I said, perfect. Among other things, I bought Mrs. Brown a sari, which she hasn't.
Oh, my gosh.
But among other things, I was going to bring Mrs. Brown a bottle of vodka. So I get a bottle of vodka. They seal it in one of those bags, you know, the duty-free mm-hmm. bags. I get to Qatar, and they say, you can't take that on the plane. And I go, what? And they go, you can't take that on the plane. And I'm like, well, look, right here on the duty-free bag, it says you can take it on the plane as long as it's sealed in the bag. And they're like, well, we don't care what the bag says. You're not taking it on the damn plane. And I said, well, I was cranky at that point. They said, we're going to check your, if you want to take it, we're going to check your carry-on bag. They said, take out of your carry-on bag, those things which are important. I said, well, everything in my carry-on bag is important, which is why it's in my carry-on bag. Right. If it wasn't important, it would be in my regular bag because I wouldn't much care about, you know, if you lost it for a couple of days. But everything is, you know, so I'm emptying my carry-on bag and I brought it back without much problems, but you know.
Oh,
but
so you were able to check it.
I was able to check it, right, but I couldn't carry it on. And you
I
know,
thought they always greeted you upon arrival with whatever you purchased.
I
haven't done duty free in quite a while, so maybe it's changed. But that was the other thing with the UAE, Dubai in particular. They said that they have a very strong drug policy, which even includes like Excedrin PM. And codeine are forbidden to come into the country. And the only thing I take is bioidentical hormones, which is a plant-based cream. And so I was trying to make sure that was going to be okay. And also I have an EpiPen because I'm allergic to bee stings. And I didn't know if that was going to be considered contraband. So I'm trying to communicate with the UAE Health Ministry. They're saying to me, go onto our website and see if it's on there. And I was like, I already did that. That's why I'm asking you for, you know, just definitive answers here. And then I thought, well, if they seize it, they seize it. I guess I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. I landed, they didn't even look through the bags. They may have looked through it when it got out of the carousel and before I got it, but nobody asked for anything, including my carry-on. So I don't know if it's all, what do you call that, all bark and no bite? Because I was thinking codeine, if somebody's got a cough and they would bring, you know, syrup with codeine in it, cough syrup, wouldn't you think that's an innocent thing? And the rule is if you have something on you and it's in your system, you're incarcerated until it's out of your system.
Well, you know, I mean, I think this more falls under the rule that if you're cautious and you check on things like this, it never, ever comes to bear. But if you go, oh, well, they won't care about the codeine, that's when you get arrested. You know what I mean? It's like when you check on it's, you know, it's like
well,
when
I was
you check
wondering
to make sure your cell phone's, you know, not in the car, it's not in the car. But if you don't check, you know what I mean?
I was thinking, though, Michael, was like, what about insulin-dependent diabetics and syringes?
Yeah, I mean, I would have never thought of it. I
would
have never thought of it. Well, you know, first of all, I'm such a world traveler, right? I dust off my passport and I'm ready to go. And my wife says to me, do you need a visa? And I'm like, what? And she says, do you need a visa to go to India? And I go, hell, I don't know. And oh, yes, you need a visa.
I had to get a visa.
Yeah, and it's not easy to get. It's a really complicated system, which you can only get online by going through an agent. And there's all sorts of visas. And so I'm going to a conference, right? So there's a thing called a conference visa. So I go to apply for the conference visa, and they say, you need a letter from the government explaining what the conference is. You need a letter from the conference inviting you. The conference needs to be approved by the government. And I mean, all this stuff. So I've been invited with like 2 weeks notice, and I get back to the sponsors and I go, they want all this. And the sponsors write back to me and say, that's ridiculous. Just apply for a tourist visa. So I get a tourist visa, right? Mm-hmm. And I come in with this guy that I was just telling you about from Iran. And we go into customs. We have what's called e-visas. We've gotten them over the internet. So we come to the e-visa counter and we're next to each other. And they go, why are you here? And I hear him say, I'm here for a conference. And they go, you don't have a conference visa. And he goes, well, I didn't know I needed. Oh, yes, you need a conference visa and blah, blah, blah. And they give him a whole boatload of stuff. And you know, and then they say to me, they go, and why are you here? And I say, well, I'm here to visit my cousin who just moved to Hyderabad to take a job in a tech company. And they go, oh, great. And they stamp and they say, have a nice day. And this guy looks at me like, oh, my God. And then when they finally let him through, I say to him, yeah, I should have told you that. I'm sorry. They told me, don't go through the, you know, just get the e-visa. They let him in, but they gave him a whole they asked him for a bunch of information and anyway, you know, and the security. Now, I don't know if this has changed from when you were there, but in the security, there were those bomb blast barriers at every hotel. Couldn't go to a hotel without having your car inspected. They x-rayed your bags leaving the airport. I didn't get that. I've never seen that before.
I don't recall that.
You had to pick up your bags and then put them through x-ray again. And I said to the guy, no, I'm leaving the airport. And he's like, put your bags through the x-ray machine. and so,
see, I never ask questions. I don't want to be on anybody's radar. So if they tell me, take off your shoes, I take off my shoes. If they say, jump around three times, I do that because I want to be compliant.
Well, and that's a smart thing to do. You know, I once was made the mistake of, and this was on a domestic flight, flashing my United States Senator ID as an ID, which is an acceptable government. It's issued by the government, you know. Right. And it took them 15 minutes to decide what to do. because they had never seen one before. And so finally, you know, and the whole time I'm thinking, why didn't you pull out your driver's license? Why didn't you pull out your driver's license? Everybody shows their driver's license. If you had just showed your driver's license, you'd be through by now, you know? Mm-hmm. So now I don't make that mistake anymore. But, and you're right, you should just be compliant, as ridiculous as it is sometimes while they're strip searching an 85-year-old lady in a walker, you know, you're thinking to yourself, oh my God. And I got, because I had the vodka, I got, frisked. They made me take off my shoes. They didn't make anybody take off their shoes. They made me take off my shoes. They went through all my luggage.
This is where? In the States?
In Qatar.
Oh, okay.
Because of the vodka. They pulled my bag aside because of the vodka. So that required that they search the entire bag. Then they frisked me and made me take off my shoes. And I mean, it was just annoying.
Nasty vodka.
After that nasty vodka.
And you know, I always have my hip replacements. They set off everything, right? So before I go through the thing, I point at both of my hips so that they know that something's going to happen. And then in the UAE, they had a woman in her full garb pull me into a room like with four walls on it and wave a wand over me, whereas in the States, they touch me all the way up to my crotch and under my armpits and everything. Yeah. And I don't care because I have nothing to hide. And you know what? I figured the more vigilant they are, the better for all of us. So do what you need to do. My dad got in trouble, though, because he set it off because he had two hips, two knees and one shoulder. And the guy was waving the wand around his crotch. And my dad said, if you keep that up, I might enjoy it a little bit more. And the guy was like, terribly offended. How dare you make fun of our process? And he's like, well, how much more do you need to wave?
Like, stop. I got to tell you, you just reminded me. I was at when they first used pagers, first time I ever saw a pager used to tell you your table was ready at a busy restaurant, you know what I mean?
Yep.
When you come in, they give you a pager. I was standing there at the hostess table when this woman walked up, a really kind of well-dressed middle-aged woman with a pair of slacks on, and she walked up and the woman said to her, "We've been calling you for the last 5 minutes," like that, very nasty. And the woman pulled the thing out of her pocket. It was vibrating. And she said, "I know, darling, but I just couldn't bear to part with it." And she had, and this woman, you know, the woman thought for a second, what's she talking about? And then her mouth just dropped wide open. And I wanted to hug the lady and go, that was perfect.
Yes,
you know, but
I was enjoying myself too much.
That's one thing I will tell you. If you're listening out there, TSA agents have no sense of humor. Follow Maria's instruction and just do what they tell you to do, even if it sounds stupid. Well, we've run out of time. I can't believe it. It's nice to have you back, and I didn't get to tell you about the hearing. We'll have to talk about the hearing. I can't believe we ran out of time, but the hearing
was American flagged with 51 stars in support of DC statehood.
That happened while I was gone. Yeah, and you know what? It's ridiculous. There was a guy at the hearing. I've got to tell you this one thing, and we'll get on to more of it next week. I'm sorry for those of you who tuned in to specifically hear about the hearing. Marie and I got carried away with our travels. But the dumbest question came from a guy who said, pulled up a map of what we hope will be the new state and said, if this becomes the boundaries of the new state, people that park on Capitol Hill that work for Congress will have to park in the new state. And if they park in the new state, then you will have undue influence over them because you could threaten their parking if they do something you don't like. And people are like, what? And Alexandria, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who AOC, who's on the committee, said, I can't believe that I'm sitting in Congress and somebody's talking about something as stupid as parking when we're talking about people's basic civil rights. So that was, you know, one of the lowlights. From, they also attacked Jack Evans, who, you know, is a local councilman who's under a lot of scrutiny for malfeasance, and they tried to make that a big issue. But the upside is that when I testified before the Senate, there were two senators there. For this testimony, there were 18 members of the committee showed up. So we're raising the issue, and we'll talk about it more next week, no matter who our guest is, because we should have talked about it today. But anyway, we're going to leave you with, this goes out to my wayward co-host, Maria Sanchez, and myself. We're going to leave you with Willie Nelson, On the Road Again, and we'll see you next week.
And thank you for making us a part of your week.
Thanks, America.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. Wi-Fi
representation in the capital of this nation. 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.